Welcome back to Listen to Your Heart. I'm Jerry.
And I'm Jerry's Heart.
Today's topic, Repatha, Evolokimab. Heart, why'd you pick this one?
Well, Jerry, for people who have had a heart attack, like us, diet and exercise might not be enough to lower the risk of another one.
Okay.
To help know if we're at risk, we should be getting our LDL-C, our bad cholesterol, checked, and talking to our doctor.
I'm listening.
And if it's still too high, Repatha can be added to a statin to lower our LDL-C and our heart attack risk.
Guess it's time to ask about Repatha.
Do not take Repatha if you're allergic to it. Serious allergic reactions can occur. Get medical help right away if you have trouble breathing or swallowing, swelling of the face, lips, tongue, throat, or arms. Common side effects include runny nose, sore throat, common cold symptoms, flu or flu-like symptoms, back pain, high blood sugar, and redness, pain, or bruising at the injection site.
Listen to your heart.
Ask your doctor about Repatha. Learn more at Repatha.com or call 1-844-REPATHA.
The Home Show with Sinead Ryan on News Talk.
Hello and you're very welcome along to the latest episode of the Home Show podcast. I'm your host, Sinead Ryan. Coming up this week, the clocks go forward and we'll be chatting with someone who has to adjust, wait for it, 600 timepieces. Do you know what a tracker mortgage is? Well, Charlie Weston will be joining me to tell us why he thinks they're back. We'll take a look at the Irish wool industry and question why all our sheep's wool is exported while we import what we need from China. And show regular Paul Kinsler, the housewife of Drumcondra himself, will be giving us some fantastic garden tips and hacks. If you'd like to get in touch with us on the Home Show podcast, we love to hear from listeners. You can do that during the week by emailing us at thehomeshow@newstalk.com. Alternatively, you'll find me on social media. You'll find me on Instagram and on X. And I know that some of you like to get in touch with me there. Clocks go forward by 1 hour at 1 a.m. and a dedicated team of staff and volunteers at the Irish Museum of Time in Waterford will be busy preparing to adjust over 600 clocks, making the start of daylight saving time. This biannual tradition requires careful attention and precision as each one of those timepieces has to be meticulously reset. Joining me now, ahead of all of that, is Cliona Purcell, curator at the Waterford Treasures Museum. Cliona, you're very welcome to the show. That's a lot of clocks.
It is, yeah, no, certainly. The ticking in there is something that a lot of people find slightly overwhelming.
And when you're talking, of course, because you have a museum of clocks, a lot of them would be original. They're not digital. They're not the ones like, you know, my phone, which resets itself automatically at 1 a.m. You have to actually go down and wind a lot of them, do you?
We do. Yeah, we're very much analog in the Museum of Time. So they have to actually be wound once a week. So a lot of our clocks are what are known as 8-day clocks, which means that they'll hold time for 8 days. So our facilities manager, Andre, spends at least 3 hours a week winding clocks.
Wow. Okay. That's a kind of a job that requires a lot of precision. Tell us about some of the timepieces you have there.
Yes, we have some really exciting pieces in the museum. I think one of the real highlights for people is what we call our Clement clock, the 17th century piece. So we're talking about 1656 for that one. And the reason that it's so exciting is it has the earliest example of something called an anchor escapement in the world. Now, I'm not going to bore you with what an anchor escapement is, but suffice to say, it's the thing that makes a clock go tick-tock. So in a sense, it's the first clock that ever went tick-tock in the world, basically.
Oh, right. Who knew? And that sound, of course, is so reassuring. I think it brings us all back to our childhood. I had an aunt who had a grandfather clock in her hall for years. All the time, I used to go down to Limerick, and you'd hear that click clock and the bongs, and you know that tick tock sound. It's kind of hard to believe it wasn't always there. Tell us about some of the other items that you have there.
Yes, I suppose it's the museum is a really, really atmospheric place. So it's actually in an old Methodist church from 1884. So on the ground floor, we have some of the earliest Irish clocks ever made. So we have about 300 years of Irish clockmaking there. But on the upper floor, we have our international collection. So we have clocks from Germany, from France, from Japan, you know, sort of all over the world. And we've actually acquired 600 cuckoo clocks from the Black Forest region of Germany recently. So it's really kind of a very broad collection of pieces. I suppose some of my favourites are the Japanese ones, because obviously this Sunday we all have to put the clocks forward, and every year there's a debate over whether we should or whether we shouldn't. But in Japan in the 19th century, there was a much bigger debate, because they actually had switched from Japanese time to what was then international or Western time. Because previous to that, Japan only had 12 hours in the day, 6 hours of daylight and 6 hours of nighttime. Oh. And our clocks actually reflect that. So it's the face of the clock says 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9.
That's extraordinary. Imagine country running on a different time to the rest of the world. Do you see much difference, Clina, in the different countries that have made, especially older clocks before there was a lot of trade and travel across the world?
Oh, absolutely. You know, different countries were known for different things. So, for instance, England were known for making sort of the most accurate clocks in the world. So if you wanted a clock that really kept time well, you wanted an English piece. And Germany were known for making the most affordable clocks. So most of the German clocks tend to be wooden. Even the pieces inside, the actual gears, are wooden. Whereas France were known for being basically useless for telling the time, but probably the most stylish clock that you could get your hands on.
Yeah, well, they have a loose definition about time generally in France, don't they? I would have thought the Swiss were the most accurate clocks. Isn't that what we normally think?
Today they are, certainly, yeah. So they definitely overtook that sort of in the late 18th, early 19th century. And obviously we have a sort of funny connection to Switzerland in Waterford as well. We had a settlement known as New Geneva, where we tried to import as many Swiss clockmakers as we could to kind of become the centre of clockmaking in Ireland.
Wow.
So, yeah, certainly the Swiss are known for it today.
OK, and tell me now, when it comes to the 1 a.m. changeover, how long does it take? I presume you're not all kind of standby till 1 a.m. and then you rush in and change all the clocks. How long does it take and what's the process?
No, so we'll do it sort of late in the day. So sort of close to closing, we'll do it. Now, it's not so bad in the spring because we just have to push it forward, basically. So while we're winding the clocks for the week, we'll just take that very, very delicate little hour hand and push it forward 1 hour. Now, in the autumn, it's a little bit more complicated because clocks don't like being pushed backwards. You can only go forward, which means you have to go forward 11 hours, basically.
Okay. So it's a different type of movement.
Yeah.
Now, you have a lot of volunteers that work down there. And I suppose being delicate and precise is one of the key components of that job. Are there some clocks that you have to be super careful with?
Oh, absolutely. You know, the older the clock, sort of the more delicate it is a lot of the time. And we're very proud of the fact that many of our pieces are unchanged from the moment that they were sold back, you know, in the 18th century. So it is a very delicate process, and every clock has its own character. It has its own quirks. So, you know, winding one clock might be very different to winding another. So we were very lucky that in the beginning, our two donors who gave us most of the pieces basically trained as many of the staff and volunteers as they could in how to take care of these pieces.
This was David Bowles and Coleman Curran, who donated to allow the museum to open.
Yes. So we started off with Coleman, and then David came on board later. So every single piece in there, and just the museum itself, really wouldn't be possible without their generosity and their sort of time.
Now, I suppose everybody has their favourites. What clock or timepiece are you most fond of, Clina?
Oh, gosh, you know, I kind of like the quirky ones a lot of the time. So one of my favourites is something called a tease maid, which a lot of people would actually possibly listening remember. They retailed in the 1950s and 1960s. But what it is it's a little clock that has a tea kettle attached to it. So you set it the night before, and when you wake up, your tea will already have been made. But as I'm sure you can appreciate, that's incredibly dangerous. It's an electric clock. So it has to have one of those big, thick electrical wires on it. It's a really, really funny little piece. So ours is from 1955.
Indeed. Actually, I don't remember them myself, but I remember them in ads and TV programmes, very, very old ones, where, you know, and you're thinking, OK, so you've all this electricity and then you have this water that is flowing out.
Yeah, oh, well, look, the price of convenience might be death. But, you know.
Yeah, and it was probably, you know, a massive innovation at the time, and people thought they'd arrived in the future. Anyway, the old tea's maid didn't make it. We now have the Nespresso in the kitchen, isn't that right?
Possibly a little bit more convenient, but not as quirky.
All right. Now, in the museum as well, you also have a festival coming up in May. Tell us a little bit about that.
We do. So we have our annual Festival of Time. This is actually the third one. And it's really, really exciting because obviously today people are kind of returning to analog a little bit, I think. You know, we went from CDs to Spotify, but now we're going back to vinyl. And I think you kind of see the same thing happening with timepieces. People are kind of moving away from the digital and they don't want to be relying on the phone in their pocket. So we bring over every year, usually around 20 of kind of the most incredible artisan watchmakers, I suppose, around Europe. So we have 20 of them coming to us in May. They're from Switzerland, from Germany, from all over, basically. And they make these incredible, incredible pieces that are, you know, wearable works of art, really. Now, obviously, a lot of them are quite expensive. A lot of these guys have a waiting list of 3 to 10 years, depending on the watchmaker.
Wow.
But gosh, one of them, his watches have been to space on the arm of William Shatner. So he's a big deal, you know?
All right, Captain Kirk.
There you go.
All right. Listen, that is really, really interesting. And if anybody wants to visit the Museum of Time, you can do so on waterfordtreasures.com is the festival website. Is that the same for the museum, Cliona?
Yeah, absolutely. So waterfordtreasures.com has everything for us.
Fantastic. All right. And you won't be forgetting now to set your own watch, I hope, in the middle of all that busyness that's going on in the museum.
I have done it, believe it or not.
Really? Already? Okay.
No. I've forgotten this in the past.
Oh, have you? Oh, right. I see. Okay. You'll have to make a note to do that. And listen, with all that going on and the expertise that you have, any idea on how I change my oven clock?
Oh, now that you need a scientist for that one, I think.
All right, okay, we'll deal with that next week. All right, listen, it's a stopped clock is right twice a day, isn't that what they say? So I'll leave it that. My oven will be fine for another 6 months and it'll all change again. Cliona Purcell, curator of Waterford Treasures Museum, thanks a million for joining us on the Home Show.
Thank you for taking the time.
Now, you might have read in the newspapers that tracker mortgages are back in the form of a new product from Avant Money. It can be a tricky and triggering subject for some. So to find out what it's all about, I'm joined now by my Irish Independent colleague, Charlie Weston, who was the journalist who broke the original tracker scandal story many years ago. You're very welcome to the show. I'm sure you remember, as I do, the ad from pre-crash times where the guy stood up in the bus and said he didn't know what a tracker mortgage was. I'm confused again. Is this a tracker mortgage or not?
Well, it shares many of the elements, Sinead, of a tracker mortgage as we know it, in that there is, you pay an amount based on a set interest rate, an interest rate that, you know, we know about, plus then a margin over that. So that's very like the old tracker. The old tracker that are still out, they're still out there, 130,000 of them. You pay the European Central Bank rate, their refinancing rate, plus a set margin. Now, with this new Flex product from Avant Money, it's slightly different in that you pay what the European wholesale interest rate is, what they call Euribor, plus a margin. So it could be 0.9% on top of the Euribor rate, or it could be 1.1% on top of the Euribor rate. And that's adjusted once a year. And you know then in advance it's going to be like that for the year.
Okay, so that kind of evens it out or manages it then, rather than the intense fluctuations we used to see with tracker mortgages.
Yeah, because the tracker mortgage rate changes every time the European Central Bank changes its refinancing rate. Your tracker mortgage rate is going to change. With this one, they will look at what the Euribor rate was for the last 12 months. They'll average it out over those 12 months, and then they'll tell you, right, this is the rate you're going to have. This is the Euribor average rate. You're going to stick. You'll have that for a year plus the margin. So you kind of a bit of certainty there. You'll know exactly where you're going to be, and also you're benefiting from the market rates, and it's safe enough as well for Avant Money, the Spanish banking group, because they know they're pricing it off what the markets are charging banks to lend to each other. That's the Euribor rate. It's what banks charge each other.
Yeah, so Avant, really, because they're owned by this big Spanish group, Bankinter, they're not getting their money from the European Central Bank like AIB is or Bank of Ireland is. They're getting it on the open market. So did I hear, Charlie, that they were thinking of coming here as a full service bank? Because a lot of people mightn't have heard of them, or they might have remembered them just in terms of credit cards. But they are thinking of entering Ireland, aren't they?
They are, and next month in April they're going to open a fully fledged bank here, which is absolutely brilliant news. Given 4 years ago we had Ulster Bank and KBC announcing their exit from the market, and they're not fully gone yet. Ulster Bank is still in wind down; they haven't handed back the license yet, but they haven't been operating here for years. So for the first time in 20 years, we're going to get a fully fledged bank. Now, it won't have branches, Sinead. It's not going to be the traditional bricks and mortar bank. It'll be more a digital bank, but it'll be a fully serviced bank. You're absolutely right. They have a very big operation in Carrick and Shannon up in Leitrim, where they offer credit cards and personal loans and mortgages. And so now they'll be expanding into deposits initially. Anyway, they'll be taking deposits. And they're quite a big bank in Spain, and they're big operations in Portugal. So, look, it's just great news. It's exactly what we want. We have a very concentrated banking market.
In terms of the competition. Now, in terms of this tracker then, this Flex product, which they're not calling a tracker, who is it suitable for, Charlie? Because I know you mentioned there, okay, people will know kind of at the beginning of the year how much they're going to pay. But there's a lot of people that like the certainty of, say, a fixed rate mortgage for a few years. This isn't going to be for them.
It's not, no. And I mean, look, there's a lot of people coming off fixed rates, and they might have got a really juicy one from Avant a couple of years ago, which was less than 2%. They're coming off fixed rates now, and they're looking at rates that are near 4% or more. People coming off a fixed rate might decide, well, I don't want to lock in again for another 4 years, because all the signs, all we're hearing from the European Central Bank is that they'll probably cut their rates again, which means that hopefully the banks here will reduce their fixed rates in the next while. So you probably are saying to yourself, it's a gamble. And I get a lot of emails, and you probably do as well, Sinead, from people saying, I'm about to take out a mortgage or buying a new house, or else from someone who's just come off a fixed rate. Or someone who's switching and they're saying,
where should I go?
What should I do here? Do I go variable on the basis that I don't want to get cut locked in and not benefit from lower fixed rates? Or, do I lock in and just forget about it? So I think quite a few people at the moment are back taking out variables. One in five are take out a variable. And many others then take out 1 year fixed, which is, not really a fix, is it? It's a very short term fix.
So exactly.
This is a way of hedging your bets.
Hedging.
But you could lock into this one and you'd know, well, okay, at any stage, Avant will allow me to fix and they won't charge me to come out of this Flex product. I could lock in once I think rates are probably going to go down, because it's terribly uncertain. Who knows where mortgage fixed rates are going? The expectation is more ECB cuts, but with Trump and his tariffs, we just don't know, Sinead.
Yeah, indeed. And I said at the intro there, Charlie, you were the journalist that broke the tracker scandal from many years ago, where it turned out that people had come off temporarily, they thought, tracker rates to go on to fixed and then couldn't get back on. And the whole delays and overcharging and everything ensued, which is still going on many, many years later. What's the central bank view, do you know, on this new Avant product, the tracker that isn't a tracker?
Well, I understand it has been kind of, they've known all about it. It's been shown to them. And they don't express an opinion one way or the other, I'm told, Sinead. But they are aware that this is quite a popular and, this is a standard product in Spain and in Portugal. Mm. A lot of banks over there would offer this kind of product and there isn't a problem with it. So that's some comfort for the central bank. You're absolutely right that the whole traditional tracker mortgage in this market was an absolute mess. And the banks completely tripped themselves up on it. It cost them €1.5 billion, 41,000 people. It had to be compensated and refunded. And huge fines had to be paid. So, but look, I think based on this one being, it's nothing innovative here in the sense that it's available and standard on the continent. Avant have access to wholesale markets, and this thing is benchmarked off the European wholesale interest rate, Euribor, plus they have a lot of deposits as well. So they're not like a non-bank lender like Finance Ireland, who just left the mortgage business because they have to go out into the bond market and the wholesale market to get funding. AIB, Bank of Ireland, Permanent TSB and Avant Money have access to deposit rates plus they don't have to depend on the wholesale interest rate market.
All right. So cautious welcome there from Charlie for that. And of course, you can read about mortgages and everything else Charlie writes about in the Irish Independent and on independent.ie. Thanks a million, Charlie, for giving us your time this morning. Janet Gallagher is co-founder of the Galway Co-op and an organic wool and lamb producer. She's also ambassador for Farming for Nature and runs several enterprises at Murray Meadows, a farm she inherited in 2016. At the centre of her enterprise is the burning desire to tell the true story of the native Irish Galway wool and its benefits to a sustainable lifestyle. And Blanadh joins me on the line now. You're very welcome. What is native Irish Galway sheep and its wool, Blanadh?
Well, good morning, Sinead, and a big good morning to all your listeners, and thanks for having us on. So native Irish wool is wool that comes from a breed of sheep that is indigenous to Ireland. So many years ago, the fields of Ireland were full of what was called the beautiful white sheep, and hence we have that gorgeous Bonine yarn. So about the 1980s, this breed became on the endangered species list for farm animals. And work was done with the Department of Agriculture to ensure that the breed didn't go into extinction and that she remains with us today. And that was all thanks to a sheep breeders association that were based down in County Galway. And hence, our national sheep breed is actually called Galway. So she's found in every province in Ireland. She's down in Wexford. She's up in Donegal. We have her in Cork. Loads of Galways all over County Kildare and County Meath. And we even have a small breed society over in the UK.
Nice.
So she's Ireland's native breed and she's found everywhere in Ireland.
And what is the wool quality like? Because I know that, you know, certainly if you're abroad and you talk about wool in Ireland, people mention the Aran sweater, which of course is quite a coarse type of wool. Is that the type of wool that the Galway sheep generates?
So what she generates is a really strong heritage yarn, and how that yarn is processed, how all strong wool from all over Europe is processed, makes a huge difference on whether or not it becomes itchy, scratchy, or whether or not it's wearable. But the iconic Aran sweater was never worn next to skin. So the women of Ireland and the cottage industries all over Ireland would have drawn the wool from this iconic breed to create what is now a multi-million euro industry. But unfortunately, the Irish native wool is absent from that industry. And that's a lot of what I try and advocate for, so that the consumer becomes aware of the difference between strong Irish wool, when processed correctly, can be worn, and wool that comes from the other side of the world. Sometimes that we're importing wool from China, from India, and from places where the animal welfare standards wouldn't be as good as they are here in Europe. And what we're trying to do, Sinead, and what we're trying to help your listeners and consumers all over the world to know the difference between wool that grows in Ireland, ideally from our native sheep breed, and wool that's imported and then is marketed, labelled and sold to the consumer as Irish. The consumer none the wiser as to where that wool came from, where it was grown, and whether or not, most importantly, as part of the sustainability design, that the grower has been fairly remunerated for growing that wool.
I think most people would be shocked to learn, as am I, that we import wool from China and India. Is it that we haven't been producing enough ourselves, or it's like other products, you know, we've been exporting more than we've been keeping?
No, we export all our wool as waste. And we don't use it in our carpets. We don't use it in our bedwear. We don't use it in upholstery. And I think it's because the supply chain broke. The supply chain broke about around the 1970s, the 1980s. And we started to import cheaper woolen, merino wool. So a lot of people wouldn't be familiar that merino is actually a place in Spain. And from that place in Spain is bred an amazing sheep called merino. And they're found all over the world now. And there are a lot of the farms are industrial scale farms. So the yarn production companies themselves own these industrial scale farms. And they can produce this merino at a much cheaper cost than the family farms that are dotted all around Ireland and indeed all across Europe. So we've become over reliant on one particular breed of sheep. And that's predominantly because of something that you mentioned earlier. That wool is quite soft. Here in Ireland, we had what were called worsted and woolen mills all over Ireland. Mm-hmm. And that's how we processed our beautiful Bonine into the sweaters. But the worsted spinning mills were closed after we became highly dependent on imported synthetic materials and indeed the merino from the other side of the world. And as a result of which, we don't actually have the facilities here in Ireland to worsted spin. So a lot of the companies, the woolen mills, so we have two types of mills left here in Ireland. We have woolen mills, and they spin imported merino wool into yarn. And then we have weaving mills, and then they use this imported wool and they use it to weave upholstery and to weave tweed and to weave blankets and throws. But we haven't been able to provide worsted yarn, which really brings out the strength and the character and the heritage of native Irish wool. And that's very regrettable. Hopefully we would like to see if the consumer becomes more aware of the fact that this wool that they're using in their upholstery, in their carpets, all Irish wool, irrespective of how fine or how coarse or how strong it is ideal for carpets. But yet we import wool for carpet manufacturing here in Ireland. All Irish wool is ideal for upholstery, but yet we import the wool for the upholstery that we find in our furniture, that we find in our soft interior fabrics. And this could change. But when I speak to members of the industry, we formed the cooperative because we wanted to have a really clean and transparent supply chain that goes right back to the rural communities that are the fabric of Irish rural society. And we wanted to be able to show the farmers, show the field, show the sheep, so the consumer is part of the journey. The consumer becomes really aware of where the actual raw material for their home interiors is coming from. But regrettably, unfortunately, we haven't really had that uptake. And when we speak to the industry players, they all say, oh, the consumer really doesn't care where the wool comes from. They just want a really good quality product. And they want a cost point that's affordable to all homes.
But we know here from designers we have on all the time on the home show that people are getting far more interested and insistent on provenance and sustainability. And we don't want things shipped halfway around the world that we can produce here in Ireland. Now, Blanid, by 2030, there's a digital product passport now coming into Europe, which means it's a traceability thing that every single manufacturer is going to have on. How do you think that's something that might be able to feature Galway wool, and how will you respond to that?
Our response is with huge and great and a very upbeat anticipation of the product passport, because despite having this clean supply chain direct from the farmer. And remember, Sinead, we're a not-for-profit. The work that I do and the advocation that I do is purely on a voluntary basis so that the consumer can have a much more informed choice. But the Product Passport Initiative, despite the fact that we're aware of it and that we're working very closely with traceability partners in Europe, we don't seem to be getting that urgency from the manufacturers of carpets and rugs and upholstery and soft furnishings. The urgency doesn't seem to be there from the industry. And despite knocking on doors and, you know, calling out to them several times and saying, look, we have this clean supply chain. We are a growers cooperative. We want to be able to have for you a product, a fleece direct from farm that could be put into the most incredible applications.
At the moment,
we sell the wool in the grease, which is the fleece from the farmer direct, at €2.50 a kilo. So if you're going to manufacture, we'll say, a very large rug, and you're going to need, we'll say, 5 kilos of wool, the base price of that wool isn't going to make a huge difference to the retail price. But having the confidence to change your supply chain back to one that's far more transparent, one that has direct links to provenance. You talk about provenance. The breed and the provenance behind this material is 102 years old. So when you pick up something that's crafted with native Irish wool, that provenance is there in your hands. It's in your home. And you can put a smile in your face and an upbeat mood to the ambience that it lends to everybody's home by knowing that you've contributed to a family farm here in Ireland, that you've contributed to the heritage of our native Irish breed. And that's real sustainability. You know, we talk a lot about the ecological footprint, which is ginormous when it comes to climate change. But what about social inclusion? What about the inclusion of all of these farmers who have worked so hard to ensure that this breed didn't go into extinction? They've created a supply chain. We run an annual harvest every year. The farmers themselves come. Some of them come with as little as 5 fleece. That's That's less than, you know, the cost of the diesel that it might cost, or the petrol, or to charge their electric car from Bantry in County Cork. But they do it because they know they're doing the right thing.
Yeah.
You know, we listen to the consumers and we hear that story about provenance. We hear the story about traceability. And we're beginning to learn now that you're right, Sinead. The consumer isn't aware and they're not being made aware. I believe they're being kept in the dark.
Well, it certainly seems kind of utterly crazy that we sell, from what I've read, 100 million euros worth of wool products, but we import all our wool ourselves. It just doesn't seem to make any sense. The Wool Co-op in Galway now, the Galway Wool Co-op, has 50 farmers from Donegal down to Cork. And where can people find out more about it, Blanet?
If they follow us on Instagram at the Galway Wool Cooperative, or they can visit our website at www.galwaywool.ie. And it's important to stress, Sinead, a lot of people attribute it the breed from the west of Ireland. She's not.
Yeah.
It's a native breed.
A bit like the Dublin Bay prawn. Right. It's nothing to do with Dublin, isn't that right? All right. Okay. Well, listen, Blanet Gallagher, a wonderful ambassador for the Galway Co-op and that breed of sheep that is native to us and which we should be having all our interior products made from. Thank you very much for joining me on the Home Show this morning. Now, as I suppose it's obvious to everyone, spring is here. Whether spring will stay here is a totally different thing. But we are all looking to get our garden into shape. And I spent an absolute fortune in the garden centre last week and showed nothing for it except a few potted plants here and there. So I am looking for some budget friendly tips to jazz it all up. And who better to ask than Paul Kinsella?
It's me.
Who is with us for our design slot. Paul, you're very welcome back to studio.
Thanks for having me. Great to be back.
Now, I'm assuming your garden is perfect and beautiful and full of colour. You're a colour maven. Tell me your fabulous, gorgeous house is full of colour in your garden.
It is full of colour from the plant side, but my grass is a battle between me and the grass every year. It's a pain in the bum.
I got rid of the grass.
I would love to, but Mark is allergic to it. I've tried faux grass. I want to tile it. I could even extend the deck and he's all no, no, no.
He likes the lawn.
And does he cut us? Not one bit of it.
Well, no, I have to say, I'm more a kind of a supervisory gardener.
Okay, that's okay. That's okay. But you're involved.
Yeah, well, I know what I want.
And he's not involved, but he has an opinion, which is very tough.
Yeah, always a hard one. All right. So, tell me what it is that you like to do this time of year, because it's a funny time. Like, when the sun comes out, you're like, oh, down to the garden centre, put down plants, and then you suddenly get a harsh frost at the end of the month and you don't know what you were thinking.
Yeah, so ideally what you would kind of advise people is not to really do anything too hectic in the garden until early April, because like you said, we get disillusioned with that lovely sun that we have at the minute and then suddenly the frost comes out of nowhere, so then it kills anything that you're planting.
Mm.
So your first kind of March is really about just tidying the garden back up, getting rid of any kind of debris. I power hose the deck, power hose the carpet or the rug that I have, my outdoor rug, and all those kind of little bits and pieces to start getting, because then you feel accomplished and the garden doesn't look such a mess after winter. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, that idea of I just want to see colour.
Yeah.
After the dead of winter and everything's kind of looking grey and brown and ugly, and there is that temptation, especially when you go walking. And I have to give a shout out to a lot of the local authorities here. The daffodils and the crocuses that you can see coming up on public verges and in parks.
Yeah.
Absolutely gorgeous.
I actually have.
I'll do that, you know.
I have a little daffodil patch in my garden that I just don't get rid of. I don't know where it came from. It just arrived, and it always makes it. I always go, oh, it's coming. The summer is coming, the heat is coming, our flowers are coming. I suppose how to start to introduce colour, I like to just do some one or two potted plants, but kind of go with the evergreens rather than it being a floral display. You can put out some of geraniums and bits and bobs, but they're just not going to grow as much as what you want them to be. So they can look a bit sad in a pot on their own.
Yeah, yeah, I know. But yeah. I still like to see the colour, and sometimes I'll sacrifice the kind of the death of the early plantings just to see it. Okay, let's start then with the lawn.
Perfect.
And no passive aggressive now here, Paul.
I'll be very good. I'll be very good. I've tried it. So anyone who's followed me has seen we actually re-sow the grass last year.
Yeah.
So we put down new sod throughout the whole garden because Mark was adamant to have the grass. But what we found over winter is you get some random patches where the grass is gone. So the best thing to do with that is, so you're going to, three steps, aerate the soil, which means stabbing a pitchfork so you can take out some anger on that ground.
Excellent, excellent.
Then what you're going to do is you're going to pop down some seed, and then you want to pop a layer of compost on top of it, or topsoil. And what that does is it protects it from the birds, but also helps the seed germinate.
Mm.
And it protects it again if you get that kind of random frost break happening in a week or so.
Okay. So you're just sprinkling down grass.
Yeah.
And do you put on the whole thing or just the patches where...
I just put on the patches. But then if there's one or two bits that aren't as flush as the other, I will go. Now, my back garden is very small, so I did the whole thing just to kind of do it.
Yeah.
But I have seen other people just do patches.
Okay, and then just let nature do its thing and don't mess it up.
Nature do its thing.
And don't cut it too soon, I suppose.
Oh, no, especially with new grass. I think they say you need to leave it about 8 weeks before you have to cut it.
Mm.
So it's just important. And make sure that the blade, and I love a really tight lawn, make sure that the blade isn't as shallow so that it doesn't remove everything.
Okay,
yeah.
All right. Now, the old hanging baskets, they went through a moment. Wasn't it Bertie Ahern who said his hobby was the hanging baskets? And you're like, okay.
Well done, Bertie.
There's a picture I can't unsee. But my husband loves a hanging basket.
Yeah, I do too.
Do you?
I do.
I don't know, there's something a bit English country garden about it, little old lady about it. And I think it's just one of those things you love or you hate. Now, let him have his hanging baskets as long as I don't have to look after them.
Yeah, yeah.
And they are pretty. They do give you a splash of colour.
They give you a great splash of colour, especially like trailing, again, geraniums. Our petunias are great for a hanging basket. And if you start it in April, they will start to grow and trail and flourish. Like I get inspired, I suppose, like you said, from the local county in Drumcondra, they have them all on the lamps as you go down Clonliffe Road. And it's really beautiful.
Yeah.
So then I have two. I keep one in the back and one in the front just at the entrance.
Now, watering can be a problem because they're hanging, obviously. You forget all the time. Then you look out and they're all withered.
Yeah.
So give us your top tip, which I have to say I wasn't expecting.
I know. Last year I tried this. So it's tried and tested and it works. So you want to take a nappy. Clean. Now make sure it's clean. And what you'll do is you'll pop in some stones at the bottom to allow some drainage. And then I pop in the nappy. And what the nappy does is it absorbs the water as you're popping in the soil and the plants. So that if you do forget in between to water it, it's going to have some water still in it.
Brilliant. Brilliant. We're all for repurposing here.
I am.
Recycling, reusing.
Yeah,
there you go.
Yeah.
Grab a nappy and put it in. And what, like, it is a great opportunity for flowers, you know, bedding plants in the hanging baskets. But there's a lovely tomato that grows. It's called Tumbling Tom, I think.
Oh.
And you can plant it in it and it tumbles down. It's meant to grow down rather than up.
Okay, okay.
And that's a lovely thing.
I've actually seen people do that in the likes of old plastic bottles. So they've repurposed a plastic bottle. They've cut out a little hole. I think I've seen a tomato plant in it. And then they've hung it up.
Yeah.
Instead of buying pots.
Yeah.
A lot of people are into recycling in the garden.
Absolutely.
As well.
Absolutely. And using it. Okay.
Yeah.
That's the hanging basket. The next thing now, I'm afraid I failed on this already. I couldn't help myself. I love a hydrangea.
I do as well.
Me and Peter O'Mahony.
Yeah.
We're right up there with the hydrangeas.
Yeah.
And I've cut mine back and they've started reflowering because we were lucky with the weather. But I think if we hadn't been lucky with the weather, I might have damaged them.
Yeah. So I watch on Clonliffe Road, there's an old lady who has the most biggest lavish hydrangea bush. And I always follow what she does.
Mm.
So she still hasn't cut the heads off yet. So I haven't. Now, like that, my hydrangeas in the front and the back have started to flower. There's lots of green coming through. But the previous year, I did cut them too early and the flower. It didn't flower.
They're such a magnificent flower.
They are.
I mean, it's just so beautiful. Okay, so hold off on the hydrangeas just yet, folks. Paul will tell you when.
I'll do. Watch me and I'll tell you. I'll go out and do it.
Life at number two is Paul's Instagram account, by the way. So you'll get all your hints and tips for that. Now, paint. So this is the bit that we have to do that we don't like doing. What I've noticed, Paul, and I've availed of it myself, is there is an enormous range of coloured paints for outdoors.
Yes.
For decking and for panels and fences and all that kind of thing. It's amazing. So it's not just shades of brown.
Not just shades of brown. And actually, Cuprinol is a great brand for colour. They have so much colour, especially if you want to pop a bit of colour onto a garden bench. What I will say about paint is just make sure you're getting the right paint for the right area. Like, you can't use a fence paint on your decking because your decking paint has an anti-agent in it that makes the anti-slip. So if you start putting fence paint on your decking, you're going to be prone to more slips and falls.
Okay.
What I found now in the last, I've weathered a few paint brands, but Cuprinol have a brand called Duxback. And it's a beautiful paint. It's matte paint, but it has a waxy coat on it. So what happens when it rains, and it rains quite a bit here, it just rolls off the fence. So I haven't had to paint my fence in 3 years since I put it on.
Okay.
Now, my sleeper is a different story because I'm in gardening and I'm hosing down the flowers all the time.
Mm.
But the Cuprinol Duxback is brilliant.
Okay. And it is a lovely splash of colour all year round.
Yeah.
I went with a kind of a teal colour.
Very nice.
For my garden is surrounded by fencing pallets and
Nice.
Do you know, there's just something lovely. You know, if you look out, even if you don't have colour in terms of plants in the garden, it concentrates your mind and gives you an
What I've done actually is, and people might find this a bit mad, black makes plants stand out so much.
It's brave though. I'm not that brave.
It's so I did a lot of grey and I made sure that Mark was happy with it. And then I tested a little black and he was like, actually, I really like that. So I have black and white. So the white wall will allow the greens to stand out a lot on and then the black fencing just ties it all in quite
very
nice.
Elegant. Yeah. Very elegant. Now we're going back into the kitchen because we're one for the composting now and we need to kind of mind our nature and all of that. And coffee, banana, you've got very posh compost.
Very posh. Well, when I do it. Now, let's not lie.
What's the thing with the coffee grounds? Because I have lots of coffee grounds and I'm never sure whether to put them directly on plants or mix them with something.
So what I do is they're great for the hydrangeas as well because it's acidity in the coffee grounds. So what it does is it actually can even change the colour of your hydrangeas. So it's quite exciting. And what I do every morning is I'll have my coffee and then I'll just sprinkle it on the soil. I don't mix it with anything.
Oh, really? That's all you have to
do? I just sprinkle it on the soil and it starts to absorb down as it washes into it.
And the bananas?
Bananas, yeah. So they're potassium rich. So again, plants love potassium. It's in most fertilizers. So again, you're just I'd blitz down the plants or the banana skins and pop them in.
Oh, you don't just fire the banana skins
out
the
back of the
garden. No, I don't
just fire them. But you could, but it mightn't look that aesthetic.
And eggshells, because that's often been cited.
Yeah, again,
as a great fertilizer.
Eggshells contain calcium. So the calcium again is feeding the plants. And actually, I've seen that some dog owners use crushed eggshells on their dog's food because it contains an extra source of calcium.
There you go. Every day's a learning day with Paul. Right, Paul, thanks a million for all those tips. I'm sure now you're going to have to post a picture of your garden.
I will.
As it's going on at Life at Number 2.
Yeah.
That's your Instagram account. And thanks a million for giving us all those tips. And hopefully we'll all get the chance to have a nice, colourful garden this year. And that's it for this latest edition of the Home Show podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. And of course, any other pods that you'd like to listen to, especially if you're a new listener, you're very welcome along. They're all up on newstalk.com or on the Newstalk app or wherever you get your podcasts from. Just look for the Home Show with Sinead Ryan. My thanks to producer Aoife Breen. Stephen McLoon was on sound. We will be back here next week to do it all again. And we look forward to your company.
The Home Show with Sinead Ryan. Saturday morning at 8 on News Talk.